If you are a small business owner, I'm sure sometimes you feel like you need a marketing degree just to successfully market your business. I'm here to tell you that is not the case if you use Constant Contact. Constant Contact's award-winning platform has powerful marketing tools to make it easy to grow your audience, engage your customers, and sell more. In just a few clicks, you can launch a campaign that is tailored to your business and goals. Maybe you're launching a new product, or releasing a newsletter, or want to tell your customers about upcoming deals. Constant Contact can help with all of that. This includes email, SMS, social media, and so much more, all designed to be easy so you can sell more, raise more, and fast-track business growth. Plus, Constant Contact's award-winning customer service is there for guidance along the way to help you with things like customer lists, templates, and follow-ups. Get going and start growing your business today with a free trial at ConstantContact.com. Constant Contact, helping the small stand tall.
Away we go, episode 816 of the Al Galdi podcast. It is Monday, April 29th, 2024, the Monday after NFL draft weekend. Have you seen the grades that our team, the Washington Commanders, has been getting for what the team did in the 2024 NFL draft? Oh, this is becoming quite the report card, a sampling, if you will, from Pro Football Focus lead NFL draft analyst Trevor Sikkema, a friend of this podcast, and A, from ESPN NFL draft analyst Mel Kiper Jr., an A-, from USA Today NFL editor Doug Farrar, an A+. And next segment, you will hear of another grade for the Commanders 2024 draft, as I have a great guest for you. Hello and welcome to this Monday installment of the Al Galdi podcast. Did the Commanders just have a killer draft? Did the Commanders, in their first draft, with Adam Peters as general manager and Lance Newmark as assistant general manager, just conduct, as legendary former Redskins head coach Joe Gibbs might say, a super smart draft?
He's super smart.
Yes, super smart. Thank you, Coach Joe. Wait until you hear what our guest next segment has to say. You know, in this wild and crazy world in which we live, it is nice to know that there are some things that you can count on, that you can rely on, that you know are going to be there for you. And one of those things is the mighty Thor Nystrom appearing on the Al Galdi podcast for the Monday show following the NFL draft. Thor, for a fourth consecutive year, is joining this podcast for the Monday show following the NFL draft. Next segment, Thor Nystrom, NFL draft and college football analyst for Fantasy Pros and Betting Pros. Now, Thor, over the years, has not been so kind to Washington drafts, and truth be told, he has been right. But brace yourself for what Thor has to say about this 2024 Commanders draft. Spoiler alert, he liked the Commanders 2024 draft. He liked it a lot. He's going to tell us why, and is going to provide excellent breakdowns of the Commanders' top picks in the draft. LSU quarterback Jaden Daniels, Illinois interior defensive lineman Johnny Newton, Michigan corner Mikey Sainristil, Kansas State tight end Ben Sinnott, TCU offensive tackle Brandon Coleman, and Rice receiver Luke McCaffrey. Also on the show, the Capitals. Their 2023-2024 season ended on Sunday night via a 4-2 loss to the New York Rangers at Capital One Arena to complete a four-game sweep in the first round of the Stanley Cup playoffs. I have a good bit to say about the game, the series, and the state of the Caps. And on the show, we'll talk Nationals and Orioles. What a win by the Nats on Sunday afternoon. A 12-9 win at the Miami Marlins as the Nats overcame a 7-0 fourth inning deficit and now have won the first three games of this four-game series at the Marlins. But the O's, they on Sunday afternoon lost to the Oakland A's 7-6 at Oriole Park at Camden Yards to lose the series 2-1. The O's in this game blew a 6-5 ninth inning lead as the Orioles closer, Craig Kimbrel, he blew a save chance for a second time in three games, and he now is dealing with what O's manager Brandon Hyde during his post-game press conference called upper back tightness. You can hit me up on X at Al Galdi. You can email me the Al Galdi podcast at yahoo.com. From Tom on X on there being a special scheduled emergency installment of the podcast for Sunday morning, what was episode 815, on which we discussed what the Commanders did in rounds 2-7 of the 2024 NFL draft and discussed the introductory press conference for quarterback Jaden Daniels on Friday afternoon, writes Tom. Thank you, Al. My Sunday was looking bleak, but I was able to procrastinate another hour before doing some house cleaning. Thank you for that, Tom. Glad to help. As I always say, never procrastinate today what you can procrastinate tomorrow. From the former United States ambassador to Belgium, Howard Gutman on X. Ambassador Gutman, a big Commanders fan, a loyal listener of this podcast, and a good friend of and strategic advisor for the Commanders' top limited partner, Mitchell Rails, writes the ambassador, for years, Al Galdi has been laser-focused on relative athletic score. Adam Peters must have been listening. Commanders 2024 draft class is the all-relative athletic score class. Thank you for that, ambassador. Yes, players taken by the Commanders in the 2024 NFL draft had the highest average relative athletic score, the highest average RAS out of all 2024 NFL draft classes. I'm not sure that Adam Peters cares what I think, but I do think that relative athletic score, RAS, RAS, is worth looking at. RAS was created by Kent Lee Platy, who I've had on the podcast multiple times. RAS grades a player's measurements and NFL scouting combine / pro day metrics on a 0 to 10 scale compared to his peer group. The idea is to give context to a player's height, weight, 40 time, bench press, vertical jump, broad jump, etc. We hear all of these numbers and it's like, okay, well, what exactly do they mean? Well, RAS gives context to the numbers. So I am a fan of RAS. From James Lacey on X on a reality with the NFL draft, writes James, the drought officially continues, now standing at 71 years. No Georgetown football player has been drafted into the NFL since the Chicago Bears took Jim Slowey in 1953. Thank you for that, James. Well, I would think that the Georgetown Athletics Department has other things to worry about right now, namely the state of Georgetown men's basketball, beyond a Georgetown football player having not been drafted into the NFL since 1953. But a good nugget from James. Email from Sterling Porter on an effect of all of the NFL draft talk that we have been doing for months. Right, Sterling? I, on Wednesday night, the night before round one, had a dream. In the dream, we traded down multiple times, ended up with the number 9 pick and multiple picks in the teens. At number 9, we took Joe Ault. Then at number 13, we took another offensive tackle, can't think of his name right now. Before the next pick, Adam Peters was interviewed and said that he was comfortable going with Marcus Mariota as the starter. Of course, we wanted a quarterback in round one, so this definitely would not have been an ideal scenario for fans. However, a scenario in which we got Ault and perhaps Michael Penix Jr. doesn't sound too bad. Anyway, I have been listening to way too much draft talk if I'm dreaming about the draft. Thanks for providing the most intelligent and entertaining Commanders news, and congrats on all of your success. God bless. Well, thank you very much for that email, Sterling. Yes, dreaming about NFL draft scenarios most definitely is a sign that you have consumed a lot of NFL draft talk. I, over the years, have had Redskins dreams. I, a few years ago, had a dream that the Skins with Colt McCoy at quarterback beat the Philadelphia Eagles to win the Super Bowl. Yes, beat an NFC East rival to win the Super Bowl. Don't ask. This was a dream, okay? But I specifically remember Colt in the dream throwing a jump pass to tight end Jordan Reed to win the game. I have no idea what any of this means. There's a belief that dreams are messages from our subconscious. I have no clue what messages my subconscious was conveying with that dream, but there you go. Colt McCoy, Super Bowl winning quarterback for the Skins, and a Super Bowl caliber law firm is the great law firm of Paulson and Nace. Paulson and Nace is a Washington, D.C.-based family law firm dedicated to promoting the rights of seriously injured persons and their families. Paulson and Nace handles medical malpractice, personal injury, birth injury, legal malpractice, and consumer protection cases, offering aggressive advocacy for victims in Washington, D.C., and West Virginia. If you have been harmed by the negligence of someone else, if someone who you care about has been harmed by the negligence of someone else, call Paulson and Nace at 202-902-7611. And when you call, make sure that you tell Paulson and Nace that Al Galdi sent you. Paulson and Nace was named as part of U.S. News and World Report's Best Law Firms 2024 edition. And Chris Nace and Matt Nace specifically are dedicated and decorated trial attorneys. Chris Nace, last May, was named the 2023 Barry J. Nace Trial Lawyer of the Year. This by the D.C. Trial Lawyers Association. Chris, last July, was elected as the Parliamentarian of the American Association for Justice, and both Chris and Matt Nace last August were recognized by Best Lawyers in America for 2024. And Samantha Peters of Paulson and Nace has been recognized as a Super Lawyers Rising Star and has been recognized by the National Trial Lawyers Top 40 Under 40. Why the accolades? Well, Paulson and Nace fights for you. Paulson and Nace has secured millions of dollars in verdict and settlement amounts for clients to better enable them to care for themselves and their families. If you have a case, contact Paulson and Nace. Call Paulson and Nace at 202-902-7611. That's 202-902-7611. When you call, make sure that you tell Paulson and Nace that Al Galdi sent you. You can also visit PaulsonandNace.com. Just make sure that you tell Paulson and Nace that Al Galdi sent you. Paulson and Nace, if you have a case, contact Paulson and Nace. Hey, thank you to all of you who have given this podcast a 5-star rating and who have written nice reviews of the podcast. You on Apple Podcasts and on Spotify can rate the podcast. 5-star ratings are very much appreciated, and you on Apple Podcasts can write a review saying that you like the podcast. The review does not have to be long, can be just a sentence or two, but the ratings and the reviews help us out a lot. So thank you very much for doing them. There to me are two undeniable themes for the Commanders 2024 NFL Draft Class. Those themes are athleticism and leadership. Regarding athleticism, the Commanders in the 2024 NFL Draft took an NFL-high 6 players, each with an athleticism score per the NFL's next-gen stats of at least 80, and we talked about this a bit in the opening segment of the show. Players taken by the Commanders in the 2024 NFL Draft had the highest average relative athletic score, the highest average RAS out of all 2024 NFL Draft classes. And regarding leadership, a whopping 7 of the 9 players taken by the Commanders in the 2024 NFL Draft were team captains. Now, does all of this guarantee anything with this Commanders draft class? No, but these are good things, and these themes are instructive as we get to know Commanders General Manager Adam Peters. I am very pleased to welcome back to the Al Galdi podcast NFL Draft and college football analyst Thor Nystrom of Fantasy Pros and Betting Pros. Thor is tremendous at talking NFL draft and college football. He is the 2018 Fantasy Sports Writers Association College Sports Writer of the Year. You can follow Thor on X at ThorKU. Hey, Thor, how are you?
I'm doing great, Al, and I know that you and everyone in your neck of the woods is doing great as well because the Commanders absolutely just smashed in the draft.
I am very happy to hear you say that. This is the fourth consecutive year that you're joining the podcast for the Monday show following the NFL draft. You in previous years have given Washington some very sobering grades for NFL drafts, including giving the Commanders a D- for their 2023 draft. But look, you with Washington have been proven to be far more right than wrong. The team's drafts with Ron Rivera as head coach look really bad in hindsight. But what do you think about what the Commanders did in the 2024 NFL draft?
Yeah, so you know that I'll tell the truth. You know, I mean, good, bad, the ugly. And this time, you know, but before the show, you know, I tell you, like, when I'm doing the draft stuff, you know, I was doing the live streams and stuff like that as it was going. And so, you know, you react to the picks live as we go along. And so sometimes it's hard to know, you know, as you get into Friday and stuff, as the picks are going, the collection that the teams have started to put together. But I looked up at one point and started to realize what Washington was collecting in the aggregate. And it was like, oh my gosh, this is starting to get really interesting. Then once it got, like, especially, you know, after the McCaffrey pick and stuff, I looked at the, like, what they had done in the totality through Friday. It's like, this is starting to get really impressive. And then into Saturday, it was like, wow, like, and in the totality, and let me just tell you the data first, and then we'll start getting into the prospects. I have a metric that judges the prospect value, the quality of the prospects that you were able to pull out of the draft. In my metrics, Washington pulled out the most talent in the entire NFL out of this draft class. They spent the third most draft equity in the NFL to acquire the most talent in the NFL this weekend. And in terms of ROI, they were, you know, upper echelon as well in the NFL. I ended up giving them an L. You know, I grade on a curve. And as you were setting up there at the top, I'm the harshest grader in the industry. If the people that like lay the thing out, there's a guy, Rene Bugner in Germany that always puts out the grades of everyone in the industry, and he'll show the GPA of everyone that does it. I'm always the guy who's on the farthest right side because I have the harshest grades. So like, you know, because I grade on a curve. So I have two Fs every year. I have two A pluses, and then everyone's in between. The Commanders this year, they got an A from me. So, you know, again, just a smash of a draft. And it starts for me at the top with Jaden Daniels. And I think that was the correct decision, you know, and we had talked a little bit about this, you know, when I come on with you pre-draft. Everyone at the start heading in, you know, heading into the pre-draft process, they wanted to just give Drake May to Washington. Washington, in my opinion, did the correct thing of looking the world in the face and then, you know, said, we're going to make our own decision on this. And then looking at those two prospects with eyes wide open, I believe that after their evaluation process, they chose the prospect that had, in my opinion, the higher ceiling and the higher floor.
Very exciting to hear that. You know, one of my favorite things that you do is your annual NFL draft big board with player comps. Thor has a 500 player 2024 NFL draft big board with player comps. You can check that out at fantasypros.com/Thor500. You had the man who the Commanders took with the number two overall pick in the draft, LSU quarterback Jaden Daniels, as your QB2, and your player comp for him is Randall Cunningham. I love that comp. What brought you to that comp for Daniels?
With Daniels, the thing that I think about him, just like as a base level for anyone out there, the way that you can think of him is he brings two superpowers to the NFL. And these two superpowers are what embed that high floor I was talking about. And it's what also starts to set the ceiling, which will eventually be informed by how the other stuff, like where do the other stuff go? But these two things is where it starts. And that is the downfield touch, the downfield, the throwing that he has, which is awesome. It's not just the arm strength, but specifically that feathery touch, the accuracy, the placement that he has, which is upper echelon. And as a kid in Minnesota with the 1998 Minnesota Vikings watching Randall Cunningham toss those moonshots that were almost hitting the Metrodome ceiling to Randy Moss. People might, you know, my formative years with Cunningham, and obviously, you know, he going back to the Eagles with him, but my, you know, Cunningham with the Vikings that year, with the moonshots in particular. And then the other thing with Daniels, he will, and people will see this very quickly with him, right away, he is going to become one of the five most dangerous scramblers the NFL has ever seen when it, runners at that position. It's different than it is with Lamar Jackson. It's why I hate that comparison for him, both as a passer and as a runner. Jackson is more the twitchy guy, and he makes you miss, and it's really hard to get your hands on him, whereas Daniels is the north-south slingshot, just shoots out of the pocket, and he just accelerates so fast. He, as a runner, it's more the guy that he's more like. I almost, especially in this context, I hate to evoke this, but this is only as a scrambler, Washington fan. So just keep this in mind. Just as a runner, he would remind me more of like RG3 in terms of that, as like the north-south pre-injury, like going back to Baylor, where he was like, you know, good at that or whatever. But like it's with Daniels, it's he gets out of the pocket so fast with that acceleration. And you see with the max miles per hour, he's like over the 20 miles per hour once he gets into the open field, but he hits that top speed so, so fast. So you bring in those two superpowers, and that's where, Randall Cunningham is evoked for me. Daniels is getting so much better in the pocket as well. And so that's the thing that's in the middle of those two things, right? Where it's like going through the progressions, and how he continues to progress at that stuff is going to inform how close he gets to what could be an atrium ceiling of his.
There in the Washington, D.C. area is a lot of excitement for Jaden Daniels, but there also is some concern. There is the concern with him not faring well in the Pro Football Focus metric pressure to sack rate. There is the concern about him being an injury risk, given his thin frame and penchant for taking hits when running. To what extent are these things concerns for you with Daniels?
The ish, you know, I would say ish for sure. A couple contextual things is that the pressure to sack rate thing, I get for sure. But the thing that I always bring up with that with him is if you modulate that a little bit, because it doesn't flatter him, especially when you do the thing where you put it up against, you know, some of those quarterbacks in the last 10 years, and all of a sudden you put it on the graph, and he starts to go close to some of those guys that busted. But the thing is, if you just switch it to the rote sack yardage, all of a sudden he moves like, you know, up the graph. And the reason for this is because of that aspect of his game where it's, again, he's the guy, he's surveying in the pocket, waiting, because he knows he has that second superpower where at any moment he can step into the phone booth and put on the Superman cape and shoot out of the pocket immediately, right? And that was the thing we were talking about, where once he breaches the line of scrimmage, it's the alarms are going off around the stadium, and the T-Rex has gotten out of the cage, and we're at Jurassic Park, and all the defenders are terrified. They're even more scared than covering his wide receivers down the field, because now they have to peel off their assignment. Now you have to corral that guy downfield. But he runs it. I wish he would have run. He didn't have to, of course, to go number two, so it wouldn't have helped him any. It was just for my entertainment, you know, everyone's entertainment. But he would have run a stupid 40 with a stupid 10-yard split. Like I said, just so fast, and he erases the angles and everything. But that is why in the pocket he can wait so long. He does a good job with the spacing, and he denotes the pressure well. That is my quibble with just sort of saying the pressure to sack rate with him without any context. And the reason that he'll take that thing is elevated is he'll wait it out looking at the downtown shot or waiting out the progressions, allowing the receivers to go because he knows he can step into that phone booth. Then he talks. Then he'll start going. A lot of these sacks that he, you know, some of these kids, all of their sacks was like 7 yards, 8 yards, you know, et cetera. A lot of Daniels's, they were like 2 yards, 1 yard, 3 yards, because it was during the process of Daniels was waiting till literally the last second. It was like, oh man, okay, okay. I gave my guys all the shot I could. It is not there. And I love that about him because he does wait. Even though he has that superpower, he is not the dude that is skittish and the first sign of anything. I'm looking to be. He will wait it out until the bitter end, but then he'll pull it. Now I'm looking to scramble shoot out of the pocket. But in that pulling down, shoot out of the pocket thing, there was times where because he waited until the last second, as he was going towards the line, that's where he was getting pulled down because was waiting until the last second. So it was these sacks that occurred right as he was getting to the line of scrimmage. So you have to give him that contextual benefit of the doubt. I have said with him that you can, like, I think it's fair to say that the sort of that calculator in his head of that moment of when to pull it, I think that can still use some tweaking. I think Jaden would say it could still use some tweaking. It's improved a whole heck of a lot over the last couple of years. So I think you can project that it's going to continue to improve as we go forward. So I would give him that benefit of the doubt. And then the other thing that I would say is the one other thing, and I think Cliff's going to work with him on this because this has been a tenet of Cliff quarterbacks going back to Houston, going back to Texas A&M, certainly back to, like his whole career is Cliff likes the guys that get out on the perimeter and then they're still the throwers. They're still threats of a thrower. Whereas Jaden, the thing with him, it's in the pocket, quiet, going across progression, then talk. Now we're running. And every time he talks, every time he pulls it down, it's immediately running. And that's the thing where, if that continues to be the case, the defensive coordinators, they're going to put it in that scouting report of the second that kid talks it, peel off your assignment cut because he's the runner and now it's really dangerous for you. I think one other thing to work on him, with Jaden with this is that I think Cliff is going to work on him with is marrying a little bit more like with your legs. Can we buy a little bit more time in the pocket to keep you more active as a thrower, to buy you a little bit more time as a thrower, because you're such a killer as a thrower. You have the good vision. And then also that would keep the defense from knowing that you'll become the runner when you pull it down, which would prevent them from peeling off their assignments every time they see, you know, that your feet move, you know, in, you know, whatever off your spot. So those would be the two things I'd say, with regards to that. And then as far as the thing in the open field, yeah, he needs to start, getting down a little bit more. I will say he took some big hits and he doesn't, like it's a weird, like he hasn't taken the injury that you would think, you know, because of some of these big hits and sometimes because of the way that he's moving, he's going at a different speed than some guys. And so like it's almost like he's forcing the issue. And so I don't know if that has kept him out of getting injured, but certainly at the NFL level, I'm sure it's going to be a different story with that. And his coaches are going to, harp this into him of like, bro, you got to get down because there's only so many of those open field collisions, those head on car crashes that you're going to take with guys that are, you know, 60 pounds heavier than you or even 30 pounds heavier than you, but they run as fast as you. Like with the force of that, your body can only take so much. Jaden's body, you know, I is very pliable and stuff like that. So I'm sure that helps. Like he has this very like sort of, a Gumby, I think that helps with it. I'm trying to think of how to describe this, but like, I think that's helped with some of this stuff, but I also don't think that that's the thing that where it's like, you don't have to slide, right? Like, I think that's the thing where it was, where he was maybe explaining it to himself of, I don't have to slide in college, but yeah, he needs to protect himself more in the open field in the NFL. And that's another one where you got to work on the calculator in his head, the snap judgment calculator in his head in that moment. And I think that they'll do that.
Much more with Thor Nystrom in moments. Someone who I know is happy about what the Commanders did in the 2024 NFL Draft. He is a great fan of the team and a great supporter of this podcast, Dr. George Verghese. Dr. Verghese is a board-certified dermatologist and Mohs surgeon. He is one of the nation's premier dermatologists, and operating under his direction is the Mid-Atlantic Skin Surgery Institute of Maryland, which has locations in Waldorf, Maryland, Leonardtown, Maryland, and Lexington Park, Maryland. Whatever your dermatological needs may be, call 301-396-3401 and make sure that you mention that Al Galdi sent you. The Mid-Atlantic Skin Surgery Institute of Maryland focuses on medical skin care, cosmetic procedures, and skin cancer diagnosis and comprehensive care. If you are dealing with skin cancer or have dealt with skin cancer or want to get screened for skin cancer, contact Dr. George Verghese and the Mid-Atlantic Skin Surgery Institute of Maryland. Heck, Dr. Verghese and the Institute offer free skin cancer screenings to anyone considered a new patient. And Dr. Verghese and the Institute offer advanced treatments for skin cancer, including painless and scarless skin cancer treatment. Also, if you are dealing with allergic reactions, if you are dealing with acne, psoriasis, or eczema, if you're interested in procedures like Botox, laser hair removal, or chemical peels, contact Dr. George Verghese and the Mid-Atlantic Skin Surgery Institute of Maryland. Whatever your dermatological needs may be, call 301-396-3401 and make sure that you mention that Al Galdi sent you. You can also visit midatlanticskin.com. That's midatlanticskin.com. For excellent and comprehensive skin care, contact Dr. George Verghese and the Mid-Atlantic Skin Surgery Institute of Maryland, and make sure that you mention that Al Galdi sent you. We're talking with NFL Draft and college football analyst Thor Nystrom of Fantasy Pros and Betting Pros about what the Commanders did in the 2024 NFL Draft. Something that I really liked about the Commanders' 2024 draft was Adam Peters pretty clearly going best player available, going BPA. That was evident with Peters taking Illinois interior defensive lineman Johnny Newton in the second round with the number 36 overall pick in the draft, even with the Commanders already having two quality interior defensive linemen in Jonathan Allen and Deron Payne. The Commanders got Newton at 36. You on your big board had Newton as the number 22 overall player in the draft. And with Javon Hargrave as the comp, what do the Commanders have in Newton?
They have interior pressure is king because it blows plays up real quick. You know, whether it's the running concept, whether it's a pass, it's the quickest way to blow up an offensive play. It just pulls the pin out of the grenade real quick. And that's what that guy does. I think the NFL was punitive with him because he's small, you know, he's the undersized three tech dude. And then the other thing is, his play style, it's so fun, but it can go against him a little bit sometimes. And I think that was the other thing when people were considering his eval is like, he's that swashbuckling gap shooting three technique. And when it works, when it's on, that's where he gets the immediate penetration. He's in your backfield and now he's blowing up the opponent's play. But there are also, of course, instances where, for instance, like a running concept, and he tries to shoot that gap. Well, then the run concept is going into the adjacent gap, and the offensive lineman with a smile is like, "All right, Johnny," but you know, it's just so easy, like you just push it. You know, like it isn't even with any effort. It's like, all right, I'll just bring you up field. Your momentum is he just made his job very easy. And so that was the difference for me between Johnny Newton and Byron Murphy from Texas, which is there was similarities with those guys as getting after the quarterback as far as like their machinations with that. But as the run guy in run defense with Byron Murphy, I saw a lot more gap integrity and keeping the responsibility with that. I also saw with Murphy the ability to anchor with his dude, you know, get up in his pads and then like set his feet in the dirt and be like, no, you're not moving me. And so he could just sort of stonewall the guard, and that would allow like the linebackers to flow behind him, which when you're playing next to Tavondre Sweat like Murphy was, it sort of had a devastating effect, and Texas linebackers would have some fun with that. With Newton, Newton is not a bad run defender, so I don't want to make it seem like that's what I'm saying, because when the gap shooting stuff is going good, on the run stuff, he can blow those concepts up quick. He also has the ability to shed in the run game and get after it. I saw myriad instances of this when he was at Illinois as well, and get after a running concept as well and chase. He's very unorthodox, fun, kind of twitchy, agile, kind of three technique in there. But yeah, he's undersized, and you have to, with Johnny Newton, live by the sword, die by the sword. You know what kind of a player he is. He is uber aggressive. That's just the kind of guy he is. I think Washington fans are going to love him. I'm a Big Ten guy, you know, coming to you from Minnesota, went to Iowa. So I watch Iowa Hawkeyes, watch the Gophers every week. So invariably caught a lot of Illinois football, watched a lot of Johnny Newton, and of course watched his cutups this spring. And that guy's a treat to watch.
You said that you know Iowa well. That leads us to this. There are Commanders fans who are not happy that the team with its second 2024 second round pick, the number 40 overall pick, instead of taking Iowa corner Cooper DeJean, traded that pick to the Philadelphia Eagles as part of a trade that brought back two 2024 second round picks, the numbers 50 and 53 overall picks. And the Commanders with those picks took Michigan corner Mikey Sainristil at 50 and Kansas State tight end Ben Sinnott at 53. And the Eagles took DeJean at 40. You are high on all three guys. You on your big board for the draft had Cooper DeJean as the number 19 overall player, had Mikey Sainristil as the number 37 overall player, and had Ben Sinnott as the number 53 overall player. He was taken by the Commanders at 53, and you had Sam Laporta as your comp for Sinnott. So should the Commanders have just stayed at 40 and taken DeJean, or are they better off having turned 40 into Sainristil and Sinnott?
This is a Sophie's choice for me because like you said, I like all three of those guys. Cooper, I love him. You know, watching him over the last couple of years, because he can do so many different things. Play him on the boundary, play him in the nickel, play him back at safety if you want. But they could do that in the NFL if they want. You can play him in the box. Play him on all the special teams units. He's a great punt returner. So that's great, and he's going to be good with Philadelphia for sure. But I can't argue with what Washington did there, because you can do that for sure. And I do think Cooper's going to be really good in the NFL, but you turn that into Sainristil and Ben Sinnott. I don't know that I'm Cooper's biggest fanboy in the world, but that would have been tough for me to turn down. Because Sainristil and Sinnott are such good players. And you mentioned like where I had those dudes on my board. Sainristil, for people that haven't watched him, watch his cutups from last season, but particularly down this stretch. That guy's smaller. Yeah. So he's going to be a nickel defender in the NFL, but he was you might even argue that he was the heartbeat of that Michigan championship winning defense. He's the guy who has in college football, you see this every now and again where it's like the dude who both seems to have a GPS for the ball, but he also it seems like he sees the play, 2 seconds, you know, like before it happens. And so, even if he's not like the best athlete, it's like, he gets it's like in a 40-yard dash. If you got a 5-yard head start every time, and that's the effect of the guys who start the couple steps before anyone else would, because they see the concept in their head they see the tell of a run concept, so they can start downhill before a guy that would be lined up equivalent, you know, in the same spot on the field. They can start their path downhill prior to that, or they see the quarterback going a specific way so they can break on a ball before another guy would. That's Mike Sanders still. So many plays last year. He made all these enormous plays and the pick sixes and all these different interceptions, and then getting involved in corralling all these different running backs, had an enormous, all these enormous tackles in the college football playoff, save first downs, you know, where then the opponent would have to punt. He is such a good football player. I had the different comp for him, but I think the equivalent for the guy in the draft from last year. So not my comp for him. My comp for him was Kenny Moore, just in terms of a closer package for the NFL. But the one from the last draft class that you can think of is Brian Branch, where it's like the smart dude in the slot, that the nickel guy that fell into the second round, and a guy locally for me that the football IQ reminds me of from college was Antoine Winfield Jr., where he was on the smaller side, was not a great athlete, but he was a fabulous college player and a tremendous college player. And he kept flipping games when he was on campus here, where it was like it was a very close game and the Gophers maybe should have lost. They ended up winning by three because Antoine Winfield Jr. would have a pick six or the Gophers would hold on to a 4-point win because Winfield would intercept the ball at the very end of the game when, you know, the team was in the red zone, or like make all these enormous plays. And it was the same thing where he would break on all these balls early or make an enormous tackle and it's the same thing. So then he goes into his draft process, and all people want to talk about is he's small, he's slow, different stuff like this. And it's like, watch his tape. He breaks early on everything. Like, he's getting a head start on the, you know, like, think about it, a better athlete that doesn't have his football IQ who has to start four steps back every single play, right? Like, he's getting a head start on that guy. So, I realize the testing, you can't test for that, but it's like he's getting the head start on the 40 on that guy every single time. So you can think about it that way. That's how I think of Mike Sanders. So he's going to be an awesome NFL starter for a really long time. He's not a first off the bus guy, but the Michigan defense absolutely loved him. And then Ben Sennett, I pounded the table for all spring, just like I did with Sam Laporta last spring. Now, Sam Laporta last spring, you know, people were like, oh, he's T5 or he's T6. And I was like, no, he's not. You know, again, the Iowa thing, because I had seen Sam Laporta coming out of Iowa and playing in this wasteland of an offense where if they didn't have Sam Laporta, would have been the worst offense in FBS history. They just shuttle the ball to Laporta, and then Laporta would go berserker on people in the open field. And Ben Sennett has a lot of stylistic similarities to Sam Laporta, certainly the same frame, same athletic traits, and then the tackle breaking thing, and then catching the ball in the intermediate, although he got to do a little bit more of that because he had a slightly better quarterback play. But with Sennett, you have a guy that can line up in line. You can line him up in the slot if you want, but you can line him up in the backfield as well, shift him around. He blocks his you-know-what off, one of the best blockers in this class. And then as a receiver, the two things that I really, really like about that kid, in particular, you know, good hands and everything like that. And he has an idea of how to run the route. He's an athletic kid. So all that stuff, you know, the treetop stuff. Yes, Ben Sennett has it, but I'm talking to like very specific nuanced things that probably weren't talked about him at all during the process, but that translate very, very well to the NFL. When we talk about JuJu McCarthy, or when we talked about Drake May during the draft process, talked a lot about how they were awesome over the middle of the field, intermediate, between the hashes, 10 to 19 yards out, and how that's very attractive to the NFL, because that's like the NFL money zone, different stuff like that. So that would be a thing that would translate. We talk about that with college quarterbacks and the translation to the NFL. We never talk about it with receivers or tight ends, the guys who are dominant in that sector. Ben Sennett is dominant in that sector. Dominant in that sector. That is where he got almost all of his usage. And you see this on his film. He has an understanding of, he's so comfortable working around bodies And he's willing to take a hit in congested quarters. The hands work just as well. The concentration, and then, you know, contorting his body around there if he has to, and then the fluidity turning up field. And then, like I said, he'll just start breaking tackles, shucking you off him. That's the thing that reminded me of Laporta when he starts running up field. It's like, good luck trying to tackle me. Sennett, I also love his backstory. It's funny that Kismet, Ben Sennett should have been an Iowa Hawkeye tight end. It just circumstances went against him, but he grew up in Iowa. It's just that, and he's like built in, eventually became the built in a lab Iowa Hawkeye tight end prototype. It didn't start that way. Like as a child, he was undersized like all throughout life. And like even going into college, I think he was coming out of high school, he was like 200 pounds, like 6'1", you know, like something like that. And so he had to walk on it at Kansas State, and like as a fullback or whatever, and then got in the weight room. And the coach at Kansas State is a guy named Chris Kleiman, who came from North Dakota State. For anyone that knows FCS football at all, you know that North Dakota State is a colossus. I'll tell you why. It's because they devoted the most in their strength and conditioning program. So that's what happens when you go there. You get in the weight room. They have an awesome weight room. The facilities there are better than anyone else's, and they keep you in there longer. And they have a whole plan with it. And guys go there one size and they come out a different size. And that's what Chris Kleiman brought to Kansas State. And Ben Sennett went there at 205, and all of a sudden he started getting bigger, bigger, bigger. But well, Ben Sennett, when he was a smaller kid in high school and when he was a boy, he played all these different sports. He played like six different sports, and he was really good at them, you know, at this smaller size. Well, now all of a sudden he's at Kansas State. You get big, 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 big. Some of these athletic skills and the fluidity that he had playing all these other different sports, they carried over when he retained the fluidity, the movement through space that he had at the smaller dimensions, which makes sense because like he had just been that size, you know, a year or two before. It's not like he had forgotten and gotten clumsy overnight. And that's what you see with him moving through space as a route runner when he has the ball in his hands. But now he has this newfound hammer of the strength, and then the weight and the muscle at that athleticism moving through space, the force of it, and he brings that to the defender who is trying to tackle him. I was bullish on him on my board. There's a lot of people, you know, again going back to the Laporta thing, it was the same thing of like Sennett got slept on all process, where you know the stuff out there of like the third round. It's like, this guy's not a third rounder. You got watch this kid. This is a second round pick all day. And like you said, I put him 53 on my board, and we got a battleship on that one. The Commanders took him 53rd.
The Commanders took TCU offensive tackle Brandon Coleman in the third round. This with the number 67 overall pick in the draft. Adam Peters, during his press conference late night on Friday night, said that he does see Coleman as an offensive tackle and that he will compete for the Commanders starting left tackle job. Do you see Coleman, who at TCU played both tackle and guard, as capable of doing well as a starting left tackle in his rookie season?
So I'll say this first before I get into my so you know I did project him as a guard and was very bullish on my projection as a guard and the way that I ranked him. However, I'm not going to argue against the that initial inclination by Mr. Peters. Because there's a thing in baseball evaluation, you know, typically invariably you draft a kid as a high school shortstop or center fielder, because, you know, in high school they were the best player and stuff. And there's this idea of you allow them to fail down the spectrum. And so you, like in rookie ball, it's like, okay, yeah, you can be the shortstop of a rookie ball team because it doesn't matter. Right. And so like, but then if, you know, as the shortstop, if they have, you know, 30 errors that season, it's like, okay, now you get to be the second baseman at low A ball. You know, you're crushing the ball as a hitter, but now, you know, you failed as a shortstop defensively. If you fail there, now we're going to try you at third base. You keep failing down the defensive spectrum. Your bat's the one that's taking you up, but then they'll keep going until they can find the position you can play at. I would do that with Coleman. Because Coleman, sure, you got the bullet of the physical dimensions are all there, the athleticism, everything like that. Sure, you want to try him at tackle? Why not? Bring him in the building, see what you got. If I'm wrong, hey, why not? Knock yourself out. You might as well try. What do you got to lose? Try him at left tackle. Then try him at right tackle if that don't work out. Then after that, he ain't going to fail at guard. And that was my whole point with why I was bullish on Coleman. I was my most ardent hope was that the Vikings was first of all, that Coleman was going to fall into a range that the Vikings could do on day three, because the Vikings were picked poor on day two. Number one, which was a pipe dream all along, I will admit. I was hoping the NFL was gonna overlook the kid again, pipe dream, but also that, you know, the guard thing, because that's what the Vikings needed. But yeah, as far as Coleman, again, you know, talk about another fascinating eval and backstory. Kid that started the sport late because his father was deployed in Germany, and so he got to the sport late, and then, you know, once he did, they come back to America, and he's in this enormous physical package, 6 foot four and a half, 313 pounds. And it turns out that he is this crazy athlete who tested with a 997 RAS. And for people out there that don't know the context of what that means, in the RAS system, Kent Lee Platt that puts this together, it goes back to testing for every player that has entered the NFL that is tested during the pre-draft process since the mid 80s. I don't remember the exact year.
1987.
Oh, 87. Okay. And it's every single one. It's not just the combine. It's also the pro day guys. But at each position, there's only one guy that gets a 10. So if you got a 997, what that means is that Brandon Coleman was, you know, like the third or the fourth best testing guard that has entered the, or, you know, NFL. I think Kent Lee Platt had him as a guard. I would have to go back and look what the 997. Okay. He did. Yeah. But obviously a stud with that. And then, you know, you look over the profile, 95th percentile vertical jump, 95th percentile vertical, 93rd percentile broad, 90th 40-yard dash, 90th hand size, you know, yada, yada, and 82nd wingspan, which I think is, you know, in conjunction with that athleticism, why you do that. And one other thing that I'll say, he got dinged on a lot of analyst boards around the industry punitively for reasons that were outside of his control. This is another reason why Coleman was way higher on my board, I think, than some other people's, because he was playing hurt last year, you know, and some of the people that do this where, you know, they're following NFL during the year and then they rank prospects, they'll just watch the cutoffs. Well, if you come in without context and then you watch their cutoffs, it's great. You're breaking down the film and everything. But if you don't know the context that the kid is gutting through pain and he's not playing at 100%, you know, I mean, and that's you're evaluating him. That's who this guy is. Sometimes, you know, as is the case of Brandon Coleman, you can get the wrong, version of him or whatever. But yeah, a kid who I think is you know, that's interesting that they're going to try him at tackle, like I said. But that for me, I do think that guard is where he will eventually wind up. I hope he proves me wrong, but I think he's going to be a stud guard. Like that's where he eventually goes. The thing that that concerns me as far as tackle goes was the technique and the footwork out there. He is certainly the athlete. But I saw some things where he could get crossed up on the boundary by speed guys and by counters getting set up out there. Things that were not, I didn't see manifest as issues when he was right, when he was 100%, when he was at TCU. And there's just so few guys that can deal with Brandon Coleman, the size, the strength, the length of that kid. And keep in mind, dude who was early on that development curve with all the gifts that he needs, now he's getting back to 100% health. This is a very fun prospect. I saw exactly what they saw in this kid. This is a fun kid to bring in.
The Commanders took Rice receiver Luke McCaffrey in the third round of the draft. This with the number 100 overall pick in the draft. You on your big board had him as the number 107 overall player with an intriguing player comp in Josh Reynolds. What do you think about McCaffrey?
Yeah, Luke McCaffrey, speaking of a guy banging the table for all process, earlier coming in, you know, was getting slept on. I don't know why. He finally woke people up with the awesome Senior Bowl and then the combine performance. But at Rice, he destroyed Conference USA for two seasons. Keep in mind, those were his first two seasons playing wide receiver. The kid played mostly slot at Rice, but again, first two seasons at the position, and they were trying to get him closer to the quarterback. One thing I want people to keep in mind, and especially vis-a-vis playing with Jaden Daniels, Luke McCaffrey is awesome catching the ball downfield. Check out his numbers with that. And also in contested situations. He's like something like 20 for 27 with that. I didn't see anyone else in this class catch so many balls, secure as many catches while they were getting smacked and then their helmet popping off. Just super impressive. The concentration and the hands didn't drop almost any balls at Rice. Anything he doesn't flub anything for sure, but just vice grip, even in congested quarters, even getting hit, everything like that. That's a kid for sure is going to be, I think, a solid slot. But I also think he's going to give more utility on the outside where you can shift him in and out than he's being given credit for.
NFL draft and college football analyst Thor Nystrom of Fantasy Pros and Betting Pros. He has given the Commanders an A for what they did in the 2024 NFL draft. Thor, awesome stuff. Thank you and all the best.
Appreciate you, Al.
All right. Hey, if you are a Commanders fan, check out bgobsession.com. You can placate your burgundy and gold obsession at bgobsession.com. BG Obsession, or BGO, has been the home of the most knowledgeable, friendly, and passionate Washington fans on the web since 2009. BGO is a special place at which you can join your fellow fans for some smart football discussion, great contests, game day chats, and even lifelong friendships. What are you waiting for? Visit and join BGO at bgobsession.com, home to your burgundy and gold obsession.
It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year.
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations. Forgotten. The history.
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Well, the Capitals' 2023-2024 season is over. A 4-2 loss to the New York Rangers at Capital One Arena on Sunday night to complete a four-game sweep in the first round of the Stanley Cup playoffs. What a lot of people expected to happen did happen. The Caps, as the bottom seed in the Eastern Conference, as the Eastern Conference's second and final wildcard team, got stomped by the President's Trophy-winning Rangers via a four-game sweep in which the Caps got outscored by the Rangers 15-7. And this happened against the Rangers team with the Caps' previous head coach, Peter Laviolette, as the Rangers head coach. A how do you like me now from old Lavi with what he did against the team that parted ways with him as its head coach shortly after the end of the Caps' 2022-2023 season. The Caps, since winning the 2018 Stanley Cup title, have not won a playoff series. The Caps, since winning the 2018 Stanley Cup title, have made the Stanley Cup playoffs in 5 of 6 seasons, but the Caps have been eliminated in the first round of each of those postseason appearances. And there's also an even bigger picture. The Caps now have been eliminated in a first or second round in 30 of 33 all-time postseason appearances. The only 3 postseasons in which the Caps advanced beyond the second round are the 1990, 1998, and 2018 postseasons. That said, the Caps were not supposed to make the Stanley Cup playoffs this season. That the Caps made the Stanley Cup playoffs this season was a minor miracle. Their minus 37 regular season goal differential is the worst goal differential for a team to make the Stanley Cup playoffs in the NHL's salary cap era, which started with the 2005-2006 season. The Caps are in the midst of a retool. That they somehow found their way into the Stanley Cup playoffs this season is a credit to the front office and head coach Spencer Carberry and his staff and the players. But let's make something clear. The Caps have a ways to go until the Caps are where they need to be. And making the Stanley Cup playoffs this season should in no way alter the team's approach. The approach still needs to be a bigger picture approach. The Caps are not all of a sudden now a win now team. No. The Caps need to continue to get younger. They need to continue to get faster. They need to find a way to generate more offense. This formula of winning games 3-2, 2-1 is just not sustainable. A terrible series for the Great Eight. I hate saying that, but that is the truth. Alex Ovechkin, in this his age 38 season, led the Caps with 31 goals in the regular season. But he, in this series against the Rangers, had the worst playoff series of his NHL career. Ovechkin, in Game 4, had no points and no shots on goal, concluding a series in which he had no points and just 5 shots on goal over 4 games. This marks the first time in Ovechkin's NHL career that he has been held pointless in a playoff series. And then there's this. Ovechkin, for Game 4, was on what was listed as the Caps' top line, but the line included Hendrix Lapierre as the center and Sonny Milano as the right wing. Two guys who had been playing on the Caps' third line. So Ovechkin essentially was demoted to the Caps' third line, with the third line just being listed as the first line. Now, Hendrix Lapierre in Game 4 scored an even-strength goal, 7:48 into the second period to tie the game at 2, and Lapierre is a part of this Caps retool. But this is notable that Ovechkin essentially was demoted for Game 4. You know, Ovi for the game got just 15 minutes, 26 seconds of ice time. We in the coming days may find out that Ovechkin was dealing with some kind of an injury, but otherwise, this was a bad series for Ovi. This was a sad series for Ovi, and that demotion for Game 4 was telling. Charlie Lindgren on Sunday night was the Caps starting goaltender for the fourth time in 4 games in the series. He stopped 19 of the 22 shots on goal that he faced. 2 of the goals that he allowed were power play goals, but Lindgren over the 4 games in this series had a save percentage of just .864. He was not the Caps' biggest problem, but he was not particularly good. You know, what you love to see in the Stanley Cup playoffs is your goaltender steal some games. Lindgren did not come close to stealing any of these 4 games. Now, a massive problem for the Caps in this series, special teams. The Caps on Sunday night went just 1-4 on the penalty kill, concluding a series in which the Caps went just 10-16 on the penalty kill. And the Caps on Sunday night went 0-2 on the power play, concluding a series in which the Caps went just 2-17 on the power play. And the Caps in the series gave up 2 shorthanded goals. The Caps in this series got wrecked by the Rangers on special teams. The Caps for Game 4 did get back 2 defensemen in Nick Jensen and Rasmus Sandin, but they had problems, and you wonder if they should have even played in this game, especially Jensen. Jensen returned off having not played since suffering an upper body injury in the Caps' 4-2 win over the Eastern Conference wildcard winning Tampa Bay Lightning at Capital One Arena on April 13th. Jensen in that game took a nasty hit from Lightning forward Michael Aisimod into the boards in the neutral zone late in the first period. Jensen was laying on his back on the ice, then was stretchered off the ice. That was a frightening scene. But Jensen in this game 4 against the Rangers had a brutal blunder. He committed a giveaway in the left circle in the Caps defensive zone, leading to an even strength goal by Rangers forward Kaapo Kakko just 57 seconds into the first period for a 1-0 Rangers lead. Jensen committed a game worst 4 giveaways, and Jensen committed a tripping minor 18:51 into the first period, leading to a power play goal by forward Vincent Trocheck 19:44 into the first period for a 2-1 Rangers lead. And then Rasmus Sandin, he on Sunday night returned off having not played since suffering an upper body injury in the Caps 3-2 overtime loss to the Ottawa Senators at Capital One Arena on April 7th. But Sandin in this game 4 against the Rangers committed a tripping minor 17:18 into the third period, leading to a game-sealing empty net power play goal by forward Jack Roslovic 19:09 into the third period for a 4-2 Rangers lead. And while Jensen and Sandin were back, the Caps still were without 3 defensemen. Defenseman Trevor Van Riemsdyk did not play due to an upper body injury that he suffered on a hit by Rangers forward Matt Rempe in the first period of the Caps 3-1 loss to the Rangers at Capital One Arena in Game 3 this past Friday night. Defenseman Vincent Iorio remained out due to an upper body injury that he suffered on a hit by Rangers forward Alexis Lafreniere in the second period of the Caps 4-1 loss at the Rangers in Game 1 on April 21st. And defenseman Ethan Bear remained out due to being in the NHL's and NHL Players Association's Player Assistance Program. The Caps in this series against the Rangers got outdone. This series, in a lot of ways, was like a flashing neon sign of how far the Caps have to go. So while it is nice that the Caps made the Stanley Cup playoffs this season, the team has got to stay disciplined with and committed to this retool, which eventually may have to become a fully fledged rebuild. We shall see. Multiple things can be true at the same time, so I would say the following about what happened with the Nationals at the Miami Marlins on Sunday afternoon. A, the Marlins are putrid, okay? But B, the Nats authored a really impressive comeback win. The Nats went at the Marlins 12-9 on Sunday afternoon, as the Nats now have won the first 3 games of this 4-game series. And the Nats in this game on Sunday afternoon overcame a 7-0 fourth inning deficit. Largest come-from-behind regular season win for the Nats since July 5th, 2018. Largest come-from-behind regular season road win for the Nats since April 28th, 2015. 9 years to the day of Sunday, which was April 28th, 2024. Quite the win by the boys.
I'm proud of the boys.
Nats manager Davey Martinez and the boys, they for this 2024 MLB regular season now are 13-14. The Marlins for this 2024 MLB regular season now are a major league worst 6-23. The Nats on Sunday afternoon were down 6-0 at the end of the first inning and 7-0 at the end of the second inning. But the Nats then scored 5 runs in the top of the fourth, 4 runs in the top of the fifth, a run in the top of the sixth, and 2 runs in the top of the eighth. The Nats for the game scored 12 runs, totaled 14 hits, worked 4 walks, and went 7-17 with runners in scoring position. The Nats' 14 hits were made up of 2 home runs, 3 doubles, and 9 singles. And the same Nats player hit the 2 homers, Nick Senzel. He was the Nats starting DH and number 2 batter. He went 2-6 with 2 home runs. He did strike out twice, but he had 5 RBI. Senzel in the Nats 5-run fourth had a 1-out, 2-run opposite field homer to right center field to cut the Nats deficit to 7-5. The homer went a projected 404 feet per Statcast. And Senzel in the Nats 4-run fifth had a 2-out, 3-run homer to left center field for a 9-7 Nats lead. That homer went a projected 411 feet per StatCast. The Nats this past December 12th officially announced having agreed on a one-year free agent contract with Nick Senzel. He was on the 10-day injured list retroactively from March 27th to April 15th due to a fractured right thumb that he suffered while fielding a ground ball prior to the Nats game on opening day, the 8-2 loss at the Cincinnati Reds on March 28th. But take a listen to what Senzel now is doing in this regular season. 39 plate appearances, 5 home runs, a slugging percentage of .639. Now, his on-base percentage is just .263, but 5 of his 8 hits are home runs. Another major force for the Nats in this 12-9 come-from-behind win at the Marlins on Sunday afternoon was Jacob Young. He is the Nats' starting center fielder and number 9 batter, went 3-for-5 with an RBI double and 2 RBI singles, and he went 2-for-2 on stolen bases. Young, in the Nats' 5-run fourth, had a one-out RBI double to left field to cut the Nats' deficit to 7-1. Young, in the Nats' 4-run fifth, had a one-out opposite field RBI single to right field on an 0-2 pitch to cut the Nats' deficit to 7-6, and he had a steal of second base. And Young, in the Nats' 2-run eighth, had a 2-out RBI single to left field for a 12-9 Nats lead, and he had a steal of second base. Jacob Young is killing the Marlins in this series. He in the 11-4 win at the Marlins on Saturday as the Nats starting center fielder and number 9 batter went 2-for-4 with 2 singles and a hit by pitch. He went 2-for-2 on stolen bases. He scored 4 runs. And Young in the 3-1 win at the Marlins on Friday night as the Nats starting center fielder and number 9 batter went 2-for-3 with 2 singles. He also was credited with an outfield assist. Another Nats player having a good series is Trey Lipscomb. He on Sunday afternoon as the Nats starting third baseman and number 6 batter went 3-for-4 with 3 singles and a hit by pitch. And he had a stolen base. So Lipscomb in the Nats 5-run fourth had a leadoff opposite field single through the right side of the infield on an 0-2 pitch. Lipscomb in the Nats 4-run fifth drew a leadoff hit by pitch. Lipscomb in the Nats 1-run sixth had a one-out single through the left side of the infield. And he had a steal of second base on a double steal. More on that momentarily. And Lipscomb in the Nats 2-run eighth had a one-out opposite field single through the right side of the infield on a 1-2 pitch. Lipscomb in the 11-4 win at the Marlins on Saturday as the Nats starting third baseman and number 6 batter went 3-for-4 with a double, 2 singles, and a walk. And Lipscomb in the 3-1 win at the Marlins on Friday night as the Nats starting third baseman and number 8 batter went 2-for-4 with 2 singles on 1-2 pitches. Alex Call, he was the Nats starting right fielder and number 7 batter for this game on Sunday afternoon. He got on base 5 times. He went 2-for-2 with 2 singles, 2 walks, and a hit by pitch. And he had an outfield assist. Some really impressive plate appearances by Cole in this game. He, at the top of the second, drew a 2-out hit by pitch to conclude a 12-pitch plate appearance. Cole, in the Nats' 5-run fourth, drew a walk despite having been down in the count at 1.02. Cole, in the Nats' 4-run fifth, had a first-pitch single up the middle. Cole, in the top of the sixth, drew a 1-out walk. And Cole, in the Nats' 2-run eighth, had a 1-out full-count single to shallow left center field despite having been down in the count at 1.12. Welcome back to the majors, Alex Call. The Nats on Saturday afternoon announced having recalled Call from AAA Rochester. This is the corresponding roster move to placing first baseman slash DH Joey Gallo on the 10-day injured list with a left shoulder injury. And Call on Sunday afternoon was terrific. Also, Ildemaro Vargas, he is the Nats starting second baseman and number 5 batter, went 2-for-5 with a double and a single. He did strike out twice, but he also had a steal of home. Vargas in the Nats 1-run 6 had a win-out double to right field and a steal of home for a 10-7 Nats lead as the Nats executed a double steal that included Trey Lipscomb stealing second base. So you look at some of the names inflicting damage in this game on Sunday afternoon. Nick Senzel, Jacob Young, Trey Lipscomb, Alex Call, Ildemaro Vargas, you know, not exactly a who's who of stars in Major League Baseball. So yes, I mean, some of this is facing a really bad team in the Marlins, but credit to the Nats for what they did in this game, overcoming the 7-0 fourth inning deficit. When it comes to why the Nats were down 7-0 going into the fourth inning on Sunday afternoon, Patrick Corbin happened. Corbin was the Nats starting pitcher in this game. He allowed 7 runs, 4 earned in 4 innings. He gave up 8 hits, which were comprised of a grand slam, 2 triples, 2 doubles, and 3 singles. He issued 2 walks. He did record 4 strikeouts, but he over his 4 innings threw a lot of pitches and a lot of balls. He threw 93 pitches, 53 strikes versus 40 balls. Corbin in the bottom of the first allowed 6 runs. Now, only 3 of the runs were earned thanks to a fielding error by shortstop CJ Abrams, but Corbin in the inning gave up a grand slam, an RBI triple, another triple, an RBI single, and 2 other singles. Corbin, to the 4th batter he faced, gave up an opposite field grand slam by Jazz Chisholm Jr. to left center field for a 4-0 Marlins lead. Corbin was coming off a nice outing. He had the Nats 4-1 loss to the Los Angeles Dodgers at Nationals Park last Tuesday evening, tossed 5 1/3 scoreless innings. But he on Sunday afternoon was back to being bad, and his stats for this 2024 regular season are brutal. 6 starts, ERA of 6.82, a whip of 1.89. Just about the only good thing that you can say is that Corbin, off giving up 7 runs over the first 2 innings on Sunday afternoon, did then toss a scoreless 3rd and 4th innings. And then came the Nats bullpen, which really did allow for the Nats to author this come-from-behind win. 4 Nats relievers combined to allow 2 runs in 5 innings. 3 of the relievers were very effective. Derek Law tossed 2 scoreless innings with 3 strikeouts. Jordan Weems did struggle. He allowed 2 runs in 1/3 of an inning. Weems in the bottom of the 7th faced 4 batters, but got just 1 out. He issued a leadoff 5-pitch walk of Jazz Chisholm Jr., gave up an opposite field RBI double by Tim Anderson to right field on an 0-2 pitch to cut the Nats' lead to 10-8, and gave up a pinch 1-out RBI single by Jesus Sanchez through the right side of the infield to cut the Nats' lead to 10-9. But Hunter Harvey then tossed 1 2/3 scoreless and hitless innings, and Kyle Finnegan tossed a scoreless and hitless bottom of the 9th for the save. A tremendous win for the Nats on Sunday afternoon. Here was Davey Martinez during his postgame session with reporters on Sunday.
This group, you know, I say it all the time, they fight, they play hard, and they're just relentless. They really are. I mean, they stick together. It's been a fun group so far. You know, they want to win. They really do. They're hungry to win, and you can see that in them. There was no give up. You know, we were down, and we kept working good at bats, and hit some big home runs. You know, Nick Senzel with 2, which was awesome. So, you know, you got to keep fighting, man. They're gonna keep fighting. You know, so you know, Patrick had one really bad inning, but what he did was, you know, keep us in the game for 4 innings, and that's pretty awesome, man. You know, and that's what I know about him. He's not gonna give up. He's not gonna quit. He gave us the innings we needed to put this all together. So it was a good day. It's a good day for us. You know, we come back tomorrow. Let's try to go 1 run more.
And the Nats on Monday evening will go for a 4-game sweep. Game 4 for the Nats at the Marlins is on Monday evening at 6:40. Jake Irvin will be the Nats starting pitcher. I have been noting that the Orioles, even with their good start to the 2024 MLB regular season, have had an unreliable bullpen. Well, the bullpen now officially is a problem. The O's lost to the Oakland A's 7-6 at Oriole Park at Camden Yards on Sunday afternoon to lose 2 of 3 games in the series. The O's now are 17-10. They, in this game, blew a 6-5 ninth inning lead. 6 Orioles relievers on Sunday afternoon combined to allow 3 runs in 5 innings. Now, Keegan Aiken was very good. He tossed 2 perfect innings with 2 swinging strikeouts. But Danny Coulomb allowed a run in 2/3 of an inning. He, in the top of the 7th, allowed a run on a 2-out solo homer by Tyler Nevin over the Great Wall of Baltimore in left field on an 0-2 pitch to cut the Orioles' lead to 6-5. The homer went a projected 407 feet per Statcast. Jacob Webb faced 1 batter and got 1 out. Yennier Cano tossed a scoreless top of the 8th. But then came Craig Kimbrel. He blew a save chance for a 2nd time in three games in the series. He fell to 7 for 10 on save chances in this regular season. Kimbrel came into the game for the top of the ninth. He, in that top of the ninth, faced two batters and got no outs. He came into the game with the O's clinging to a 6-5 lead. But Kimbrel issued a leadoff four-pitch walk of Durell Hernandez and then gave up a go-ahead, full-count, two-run homer by Oakland's number 9 batter, Kyle McCann, to right field for a 7-6 A's lead. O's manager Brandon Hyde then removed Kimbrel from the game due to what Hyde, during his post-game press conference, called upper back tightness. Dylan Tate, in the top of the ninth, faced three batters and got three outs. But what happened with Kimbrel is what sticks with you. And it's off what happened with Kimbrel in the 3-2 10-inning loss to the A's on Friday night. Kimbrel, in that game, faced five batters but got just one out. He threw 24 pitches, a mere 8 strikes versus 16 balls. Here was Brandon Hyde during his post-game press conference on Sunday on Craig Kimbrel, and you'll hear multiple follow-up exchanges as Hyde, in the top of the ninth on Sunday afternoon, made multiple mound visits to Kimbrel.
Well, he's in the training room now. Right now, he's just got some upper back tightness, and so he's kind of just being evaluated right now.
When you went out the first time,
yeah,
was that also the same thing? And he convinced you he was
really. Well, yeah, then he threw a pitch and it looked good and felt right, and kind of just trust the player at that point when he says he's good to go. So, maybe the long AB. I don't know. I'm not sure.
Was it something you noticed in his delivery that prompted you all to go out there?
The way he was walking around just didn't look right, so we wanted to make sure he was okay.
Brandon, obviously you've been leaning hard on this bullpen for the last week or so. What's it feel like to have another, potential concern with one of your workhorses?
Yeah, it's part of the game, so other guys are gonna have to step up and need to pitch well out of the bullpen. Just next guy up type of mentality. I don't know how long, what the timetable is with Craig, if any at all. We'll see. But I think we've been playing pretty good baseball. We just had a couple unfortunate kind of endings here this series. Had a chance to win all three games and move on to tomorrow.
Well, this season is Craig Kimbrel's age 36 season. The O's this past December 6th announced that they had agreed to terms with Kimbrel as a free agent, a one-year contract for the 2024 season with a club option for 2025. The contract is a one-year $12 million contract with a $1 million buyout for a $13 million club option for the 2025 season. The contract actually is the richest free agent contract given out by the O's since Mike Elias was named as the team's executive vice president and general manager on November 16th, 2018. And remember, the Orioles ace reliever from last season, Felix Bautista, is out due to having undergone Tommy John surgery last October. The Orioles' starting pitcher for this 7-6 loss to the A's on Sunday afternoon was Albert Suarez. Albert Suarez had become a nice story. The O's last September signed him to a minor league contract. This season is his age 34 season. The O's on April 17th announced having selected the contract of Suarez from AAA Norfolk. He and the Orioles' 4-2 walk-off win over the Minnesota Twins at Oriole Park at Camden Yards on April 17th pitched in a major league regular season game for the first time since September 26, 2017, and he did well. He tossed 5 2/3 scoreless innings. Then he in another 4-2 Orioles win, the 4-2 win at the Los Angeles Angels late night last Monday night, April 22nd, tossed another 5 2/3 scoreless innings, this with 5 strikeouts. But Suarez on Sunday afternoon had some problems. He allowed 4 runs in 4 innings. He gave up 7 hits, which were a home run, a double, and 5 singles. He did have 6 strikeouts versus 1 walk, and he did throw a lot of strikes, 83 pitches, 55 strikes versus just 28 balls. The Orioles' offense in this 7-6 loss to the A's on Sunday afternoon was pretty good. The O's scored 6 runs. The O's had 9 hits, which were 3 home runs, a double, and 5 singles. The O's did draw just 2 walks, did go just 1-for-7 with runners in scoring position, and did strike out 12 times. So the offense wasn't perfect, but look, 6 runs should be good enough to win. A good game for Ryan Mountcastle. He is the Orioles starting first baseman and number 5 batter. Went 3-for-4 with a 2-run homer, 2 singles, and a stolen base. So Mountcastle ended Orioles 3-run third, had a 2-out, 2-run homer to center field for a 5-4 Orioles lead. The homer went a projected 424 feet per Statcast. Mountcastle for this regular season is number 2 among all qualified Orioles players in OPS 906. Next up for the O's is a big series, a 4-game series against the New York Yankees at Oriole Park at Camden Yards, a battle of the top 2 teams in the American League East. The Yankees for this regular season are 19-10. The O's for this regular season are 17-10. Game 1, Monday evening at 6:35, Grayson Rodriguez will be the Orioles starting pitcher. Game 2, Tuesday evening at 6:35, Dean Kramer will be the Orioles starting pitcher. Game 3, Wednesday evening at 6:35, Corbin Burnes will be the Orioles starting pitcher. And Game 4, Thursday afternoon at 1:05, the Orioles starting pitcher for that game is to be announced, but the Orioles starting pitcher for that game could be Kyle Bradish. He since March 28th, retroactive to March 25th, has been on the 15-day injured list due to a right UCL sprain, but Brandon Hyde, in a pregame session with reporters on Saturday, said that Bradish's minor league rehab assignment was ending early, and he is headed back to the major league rotation. We'll see exactly when. And that will do it for you and me for now. Keep the feedback coming. You can hit me up on X at Al Galdi. You can email me the Al Galdi podcast at yahoo.com. Tuesday show, episode 816. We'll have plenty for you on the Commanders. Also on Tuesday show, I'll talk Nationals and Orioles. The Nats are at the Miami Marlins Monday evening at 6:40 for game 4 of a 4-game series. The O's are home to the New York Yankees Monday evening at 6:35 for game 1 of a 4-game series. Have a great rest of your Monday, and I'll talk to you on Tuesday.
He's super smart.
Everyone is talking about magnesium. It's all you hear about. But why? What do we know about magnesium? Well, magnesium is the number one mineral that 75% of Americans are deficient in. If you are a woman over 35, magnesium will help you rediscover balance, energy, and vitality. Magnesium supports more than 300 enzymatic reactions in your body, including those involved in hormonal balance. From functional medicine doctors to mental well-being and female hormone experts, we all know that magnesium is the one mineral to improve all aspects of well-being and health. But which one? Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers, the trusted choice recommended by leading experts, with 7 best-absorbed forms of magnesium to ensure your body receives the support it needs for overall well-being. Go to bioptimizers.com/balance today and use code BALANCE10 for 10% off. Support your journey to wellness at bioptimizers.com/balance. Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers, your foundation to optimal health and vitality.